Let's start. Arusa, Rabosa, we started a little late today. Let's see what we can accomplish. Now, Rabosa, just by way of introduction, we want to know exactly which woman is included in Sota. We know that she has to have Kini and Stira, and then we go through the whole process. We bring the Beis HaMikdash, and we bring a Minchas Sota, and we Mashka Mayim Marad. We know all that. But there are many different categories which might undermine the parasha of Sota. In other words, there are exclusions where even though she had Kini and Stira, nevertheless she doesn't generate the whole procedure of Sota. One of them is called an Arusa. Does anybody here know what an Arusa is?
Engaged.
Well, David, you're right, but this is one of those cases where the English translation is just... it just undermines, it just destroys us, because halakhically an engagement is worth next to nothing. I wouldn't say nothing. It's called shiduchim in the Gemara, and it could be that the engagement does generate certain obligations, but basically that's not what we talk about. So the word engagement is just a, if you pardon the expression, it's like an amaratzis, or way of for ignoramuses who have no orientation. And I respect you guys, so I think you have an orientation in Torah. The word engagement is not acceptable for me. But that's not a critique, David. I'm not criticizing.
If the engagement includes the verbal acceptance by the woman of a proposal for marriage, and it includes a ring, which is valuable and comes from
The ring is a little, that adds a little bit. But let me ask you a question. In modern English, or in Australian English, if I would tell you this girl is engaged,
yes,
and then I told you that a man had a relationship with her, what would you say about that man? A man other than her fiance?
I don't know.
Would you punish him?
Yes, in a Torah sense.
I'm asking you just, you know, because what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to understand. Yeah, we're learning. You know, one of the disciplines in psychology is language communication. It's a whole, you can get a PhD in language communication. So what I'm asking you is, when you hear the word engaged, maybe you know, you're a London and you think of it in the way we're talking here about an Arusa, but if you use the word engaged, in your mind, does that mean that if somebody would take this woman out for dinner and then have, you know, an intimacy with her, that we should put that person to death?
No, I think you just beat him up.
I want you to know, an Arusa, listen carefully, if a man would have a relationship with an Arusa, we put him to death.
Yeah, right.
Are you listening to me? That's why I don't like the word engaged, because when you talk, my sister was engaged, and unfortunately it didn't work out. So they broke the engagement. She was not married. She was never married. An Arusa is married. In halachic terms. So let's just go over the basics. That was just a side comment. Is that all right, David? No, just saying, because language, so, you know, when you translate something into English, you lose a lot, because I'm not saying in this case, but at least from my perspective, you associate certain concepts with certain words based on the English language. And engagement means, you know, you and I have decided that we're going to get married. That has no halachic significance. I mean, it does have significance in terms of shiduchim. It could be that there are certain penalties you have to pay if you break up the engagement. But zilch, it's mamish like nothing. It's not even a drop in the bucket. Erusin, on the other hand, is actual marriage. It means that she is what's called an eshes ish. She's a married woman. And if she wants to marry someone else, she'll need a get, just like any other married woman. And according to Torah law, if she's engaged to a Kohen and she's not a Kohenes, she's allowed to eat truma. And I can go on and on and on. The law of Erusin is basically marriage. Narvas. We need another stage to take her out of her home and bring her into his home. And that's called what, everybody?
Nisuin.
So we're talking about an Arusa. And what the Gemara is going to establish is that the parasha of Sota only applies to a Nesua, and it doesn't apply to an Arusa. And that means, despite the fact that she is considered an Eishes Ish, she's married. And as we said before, the penalty would be a death penalty. So if she would be guilty, chas v'shalom, an adulterous relationship, it's a chiyuv misa. She'd be put to death, and the boel would also be put to death. But nevertheless, she is not included in the parasha of Sota. Are you with me, Alan? So far?
So an Arusa needs a get.
Arusa needs a get. if anyone goes near her without a get, if you know what I mean, he will be put to death, she'll be put to death if she was a consenting adult. So again, this is all the case of an arusa. The Mishnah is giving us a list of those ladies that will not drink from the maid Merarim. And we're going to have to go through every case and see why not. But I just want you to be aware of the revolutionary chiddush here, this Mishnah. I would have said that Arusa, since she is an Eishes Ish, she's included in Sota, but for one reason or another, we'll see the drushes that Chazal are going to derive, she's not included in the parasha of Sota. Then we get to the next category. And that's called Shomeres Yavam. Now that means that a woman was married, fully married. She's in a sua. Her husband died. And he left no children. But he did leave a surviving brother. In such a case, her status right now, at this moment that her husband dies, is that of a Shomeres Yavam. Shomeres Yavam means she's sitting and waiting. And one or two possibilities could occur. Either the Yavam, who is the live surviving brother, will give her chalitza, or he will marry her. Her state at this particular point is called Zika. I don't know if you remember that word. I once promised you I would wake you up in the middle of the night and ask you for the word Zika. Yeah. And Zika is marriage. There is a marriage relationship between her and the Yavam. He can decide to give a chalitza, which is equivalent to a get, just like a man who's married could deliver a bill of divorce. So too his bill of divorce is chalitza. But in the meantime, until he gives her chalitza, she is married to him. Now that marriage is an incomplete marriage. It's called zika. It is what we call ishus. Ishus is the general term. It's the umbrella term for all halachic marriage relationship between a husband and a wife. She does have ishus, but the ishus is incomplete ishus. It's very fascinating. The halacha doesn't work with all or nothing. Usually, you know, in legal terms, you know, we say, I don't know if you're familiar with the phrase, either she's pregnant or she's not pregnant. She can't be half pregnant. And usually in halachic terms, it's either black or white. There's no gradations. But there are many, many halachas which work in gradations. I'll give you an example. If I were to ask you, this person is non-Jewish and we want to make him Jewish, what's that called? In halachic terms, when you want to, you know, through a certain process, make someone who's not Jewish, Jewish? Gerus, right? Everybody's with me? Gerus? You with me? Conversion? Now, if I were to ask you, again, for a knee-jerk response, is he a ger or is he not a ger? Has he converted or is he not converted? You would say to me, yes or no. And there's no middle gradation, right? Either she's pregnant or she's not pregnant. She can't be half pregnant. He can't be a half ger. Well, that's not true. The halacha sees gerus as a long, complicated process. And at every stage in the process, your status changes until you become a full-fledged ger. For example, there's something called a ger tosha. And then there's something called an eved, who has a different gerus. And then we have a full-fledged gerus. And it goes up and up and up. So halachic terms work with not black and white, but with the gray area where there's a process. And a typical example of that is yibum. Yibum is ishus, but in motion, in process. So at stage number one, her husband dies. At this point, she's called the Shomeres Yavam. She is linked up in a marriage relationship called ishus with the Yavam, but it's not a full-fledged ishus. The culmination of that ishus will be when he has a relationship with her in intimacy, and that will clinch the relationship. It's interesting, by the way, that because Shomeres Yavam is already somewhat married to the Yavam, there's going to be a difference then in that case then marrying a woman who was he was never married to in terms of Bia. Bia means an intimacy which creates marriage. So for example, in the case of a Pnuya, that means an unmarried woman who could be married through Bia, that's one of the three possibilities. That's the first Mishnah Kiddushin. We don't do it today, but it was common in the back of the day. He needs what's called Gmar Bia. Gmar Bia means that the organ has to go totally inside. You understand? It can't be just some sort of superficial contact. Not so in the case of Yavam. because he doesn't have to create Ishus from nothing. He's already somewhat married to her. So to complete that Ishus, all he needs is what's called Tchilas Bir, which means that the crown goes into the vagina, but you don't need total penetration. And all that is based on the fact that in the case of Yovan, it's just a clincher. She's already married. We're, shall we say, 70%, 80%, I don't know, 90%? So how much along the line are we? So this is a gigantic machlokas between Rav and Shmuel in Masechet Yevamos. Rav is of the opinion that if another man would have a relationship with the Shomeres Yovam, if she would be in an adultery relationship other than the Yovam, he's chayv kares. That means he's cut off. And the child is a mamzer. Shmuel says no. Shmuel says it's an Isur Lav, it's a lowercase Isur, because the marriage only goes that far, but not all the way, and the child is not a mom's. So again, you see that Rav and Shmuel were at loggerheads. They didn't understand how much is she married? How pregnant is this woman? But our Mishnah is teaching us that despite the fact that a Shomeres Yovam is quote-unquote married to the Yovam, and there's a Zika relationship which is Ishus, nevertheless she's not in the Parasha Vot of Sota. She's not included in the laws of Sota. And therefore, Lo Shosos, they will not drink from the waters. So what do we do with these women? You know, they violated Kinui and Stira. Right, the Yovam said, hey, I see you hanging around with this guy over here, don't you hang around with him, and then she secluded herself with this guy. That's called Kinui and Stira. Or in the case of an Arusa, now the flip side of an Arusa, her married partner is called the Arus, Aleph Reish Vav, somebody you just dropped the hay. So the Arus warned the Arusa, his Arusa, he said to her, don't go hanging around with this guy. Don't be secluded with him. And she did so. So what do we do now? There's no Parshav Sota. There's no Memorarim. So what happens now? So the Mishnah says he's going to have to divorce her, or in the case of Yevama, he's going to have to give a Chalitza. Velo Notlos Ksuba. Now, let's talk a little about the Ksuba. There's a fantastic sugya in a masechta that's dedicated to the ksuba called ksubas, about whether ksuba is doraisa or drabbanan. Is the entity of ksuba a Torah entity, or it's only drabbanan? Either way, a woman only has a right to collect her ketuba if she lives within the reign, within the, you know, the parameters of marriage. If she violates the parameters of marriage, then at that point she forfeits her rights to a ksuba. So even though in these two cases of an arusa or a shomeres yavam, there's no sota process, but nevertheless she will have to be divorced, and I'll explain that in a minute. But not only will she be divorced, but she cannot collect her ksuba. So listen carefully. The fact that she violated his kinui and she had stira, that itself is on her part, forfeits her rights to what? To the ksuba. Now, why does he have to divorce her? And the answer is because we suspect her of having this adulterous relationship. And even though the marriage has not reached its fruition to Nisuin, it's only Erisin, nevertheless her adultery is enough to generate an Isur, a prohibition that she's not allowed to return to her husband. And basically it means they'll never culminate the marriage.
Arusa gets a ketubah?
I don't know. That's a great sugya in Masechta
Ketubah. You said she has to give back her ketubah.
Well, not that she doesn't. Well, I wouldn't say she has to give back the ketubah, but yeah, I mean, she doesn't collect her ketubah. Yeah, you're right. Same thing. So it seems that this Mishnah, that's going to be the sugya of the Gemara here, does not accept Nisuin as the prerequisite for a ketubah. Now, it works like this. Just to give you a clue, David, basically, an arusa should collect a ketubah in general. However, for one reason or another, Chazal said, we're going to delay it. We're going to wait until Nisuin. But once she collects the ksuba, she collects it from the moment of Erisin. And this has to do with the laws of Shibudim, of liens and loans and so forth and so on. that basically he owes her the ksuba from the moment of erusin, but that's only collectible after nisuin. But once it's collectible after nisuin, it's collectible l'mafreya retroactively from the time of erusin. So a woman's right to the ksuba really is clinched with erusin, but in a case where she had an adulterous relationship, well, we don't know she did, but she did enough for us to suspect where the smoke is fire, she loses her rights to the ksuba. Shenemar. Now this Shenemar is teaching us not that she forfeits her ksuba, but that she's not included in the parsha of Sota. Why? So here we open up to Parshas Noso. I don't have a chumash here, but maybe we'll do this a little later. And in Parshas Noso, it says the following, Asher tiste isha tachas ish. Okay, then that's the opening line in Parshas Noso, that she strays tachas ish. Actually, it says tachas isha because the hay has what's called a mapik in it. It has a dot in the hay, which is called a mapik hay, and that is possessive. So it's ish shalom, her husband. So that's called isha. But the key word here is the word tachas. Tachas means in the Chazal that she is living together with her husband in one house, to the exclusion of these two categories. Number one, in Arusa, the Arusa remains until the Nisu and until the Chuppah in the house of her father, so she's not tachas isha. And the case of Shomeres Yavam, that until the Yavam consummates this Yimum, she remains in her own house. She does not enter into his house. So in a certain extent, both the Arusa and the Shomeres Yavam are similar, they're almost identical, because they have not yet entered into the home of their husband. And the Torah says in the parasha of Sota, Asher tista isha tachas isha, and it's got to be tachas isha, prat to the exclusion of Arusa and Shomeres Yavam. Now the Mishnah goes on to talk about what's called Chayvei Lavin. Okay, let me just write this on the board. Okay, we have something called Chayvei Lavin. And again, I write it on the board only because I think you guys are so great that you'll certainly have a notebook and write this in your notebook.
Checking.
Am I being very naive? I know I'm being naive, but let me be naive because I'd rather be naive and live in a fantasy than the opposite. So let me be naive and really take the effort to write this on the board, because I know you're going to write this down in your notes.
Jackie,
so we have now Chayvei Lavin. Okay? Now, this Lavin is the plural of the word Lav. Lav means Olotase. Now, when we speak about Chayvei Lavin, this is a concept that the opposite, in contrast, is Chayvei Krisus. Or in real fancy Hebrew, it's Kretot. But okay, in the yeshivas, we always called it Krisus. Okay? The punishment for Chayvei Lavin is, anybody? Is Malkos. The punishment for Chayvei Krisus, obviously, is Karis. This is a much more severe punishment. And now exactly what it means, I don't know. Complicated. Let's say he'll die before the age of 60, whatever it is. Fine. So now, what happens if this woman, who, let's say, violated Kiri and Stira, was in a situation of Chayvei Lavin? So let's read the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Almana l'kohen gadol, grusha v'chalutza l'kohen hejot, and mamzeres.
Okay, please explain the first one.
Yeah, I'm going to go through all of them one by one. Trust me, I'm just giving you the flow of the Mishnah, just the words of the Mishnah. You don't even know what these words mean, but just to hear the words of the Mishnah. Nesina li Yisrael, bas Yisrael lemanzu lenosin, lo shosos. Okay, so these are categories called Chayvei Lavin. Now let's go through one by one, Chayvei Lavin. A man marries a woman against the Torah law. So there's already treif, you know, the marriage is treif. if you follow what I mean. I'm using the word treif just as an idiomatic phrase.
But it's accepted.
Oh. Why is it accepted? It's a valid marriage because it's only chayvei lavin. If a man would, let's say, marry his own sister, that's chayvei krisus, the marriage is completely null and void. It doesn't register. So for sure there wouldn't be sota for such a marriage. What we're talking about, would there be sota in a marriage that's treif, but it's a marriage? It's an unacceptable, unkosher relationship. He had no right to marry her, but he went ahead and he married her. Like, for example, in one shul, I don't want to mention the name of the shul, but there was a rumor going around that a certain kohen was married to a grusha. Now, a kohen is not allowed to marry a grusha. She's been married before and she was divorced. If she was married before and she became a widow, her husband died, then a kohen's allowed to marry her. Not a kohen gadol, but a regular kohen's allowed to marry her. But if she was married before and she got divorced, a kohen is not allowed to marry her. Now, let's say a kohen went ahead and married a divorcee. So it's a marriage relationship. That relationship is called chayvei lav. What does that mean? That every time he has a relationship with her, an intimacy, he's going to get malchus. Every single time for the rest of his life. Again, if there were Edom and Asra and so forth and so on. So the marriage, as I said before, is treif. It's not something that's kosher v'yosher. But the marriage is still valid. Why? Because the Torah excludes a marriage when the isur, the prohibition between him and her, reaches the level of chayvei krisus. It's a very severe, incestuous relationship, let's say. I mean, it goes even beyond incest, but I'm just making life easier for ourselves. So, you know, if a man would marry his sister, as I said before, that's not even marriage. We're talking about a marriage which the Torah validates. And she is an eish ish. And it means that if she would go ahead and have a relationship with another man, that's a capital crime. But nevertheless, the marriage is not kosher. Now she goes ahead and has this relationship, or was suspected because she had kinyan stira. Is she included in sota? And what this mishnah is going to tell us, that the parasha of sota, and we're going to learn it from a pasuk, only applies when the marriage itself is a kosher marriage. From the get-go, there was no prohibition. So now the mishnah is going to give us a whole list of marriages which are excluded from sota because they are chayvei lavin, they're treif marriages. The first case is almana l'kohen gadol. The Torah says, for who isha b'psuleh yikach, that he, the kohen gadol, has to marry a b'sula, a woman that was never married before. And the kohen now, he's a kohen gadol, went ahead and he married a b'ula. A b'ula means an almana. An almana means that she was married and her husband died. That means we have every reason to assume that she is a ba'ula, that she already had a relationship with her husband, never he died. And if she wants to marry a kohen, she can marry a kohen. But she can't marry the kohen gadol, because the Torah says the kohen gadol has to marry a basula. Don't ask me why, I have no clue, but that's what the Torah said. It's a pasuk in Chumash. Now the kohen gadol went ahead, and you would never suspect the kohen gadol to do this, and he married an almana. Shrei, chai v'kayim, you could yell and scream, you know, and those who danced at his wedding, they also should be punished.
But would Rabbi can Mekadesha him? Like, wouldn't that happen in Israel?
I don't know. I have a feeling there was no rabbi there at the marriage. I have a feeling there were just two witnesses. You don't need a rabbi for a marriage.
Is he chai v'krisus?
No, it's only chai v'lav. Chai v'krisus means the marriage is null and void.
The Kohen Gadol, I'm saying
that. I'm saying, if the Kohen Gadol marries an almana, that's not chayvei krisus. If it would have been chayvei krisus, then it wouldn't be in this mishnah, because if it's chayvei krisus, the marriage is not valid. So of course, there's no sota. If there's no marriage, the mishnah is telling me that even though the halacha recognizes the marriage, she's an absolute, full fledged eishes ish. If anyone would have a relationship with her, the adultery, the he and she would be put to death. But nevertheless, it's not a kosher marriage.
You couldn't take away the kohen gadol away from that man and give it to somebody else?
What are we talking about? Take away who? Take away...
The guy who's Kohen Gadol, who marries now an almana.
Right.
Right? Have him abdicate the Kohen Gadol and give it to another person.
Does it disqualify him as being a
Kohen
Gadol? Disqualify
the Kohen Gadol. Oh, I didn't understand what you're saying. Oh, we should disqualify the Kohen Gadol.
Yeah.
Could be, you're right. But again, we're not talking about disqualifying the Kohen Gadol. We want to know if his wife had kiri and stira, whether she drinks the mei merorim. Is she part of the marriage sota? You're asking a different question. I mean, for that we'd have to learn, you know, different sugyas in Sanhedrin and other mesechtas about what's the status of a Kohen Gadol if he violates the law. Can we depose him? Is he automatically deposed? I mean, those are sugyas. But our problem is that we have an unkosher marriage. So our mission is listing all those non-kosher marriages which are excluded from the parasha of Sota, even though she's a full-fledged married woman. She's an Eishes Ish. Next case is Grusha. Now I'm going to skip a word for a second. Le-Kohen Hedjot. Every other Kohen except the Kohen Gadol is called the Kohen Hedjot. He's a rank and file Kohen, and he's not allowed to marry a Grusha. The Torah says that Grusha Vizona Lo Yikach. Again, it's only Chayve Lavim. He went ahead and he married a Grusha. He'll get Malkus 39 lashes for every single relationship that he has with her. But nevertheless, the marriage is a valid marriage. And if she would have an adulterous relationship, then she would be put to death, and the adulterer would also be put to death. But nevertheless, this woman would not drink from Mei Merorim. There's no parasha of Sota because the marriage is not kosher.
But it's a total contradiction in terms.
What do you mean?
I don't accept it as a marriage. You don't sleep with someone.
Okay, so again, here's the deal. We do accept it as a marriage, but it's not a kosher marriage. It's a valid marriage. You see, in your mind, what you're doing is you're equating two things, A equals B. If it's a non-kosher marriage, we can't recognize the marriage. And I understand where you're coming from. It makes sense. You know,
that's why we have a Mishnah.
If it's not kosher, then it's not a marriage. But that's not how halacha works. There are two different laws over here, and we should separate them with a big wall. One law is he allowed to marry her? Is he not allowed to marry? Will he get punished? And so forth and so on. The other part of the wall, on the other side of the wall, is do we recognize the marriage? And here the law changes whether, you know, there's a whole hierarchy. On the top of the hierarchy is what's called chayvei misas. Let's say a man would have a relationship with his own mother, we put him to death. Below that, a man has a relationship with his sister, he gets kares. Below that, a kohen marries a grusha, and that's a chiv malchus. So we have a whole hierarchy. And in this hierarchy, we divide it up into two. If it's a chayvei krisus, and how much more so a chayvei misas bezdin, if that's the nature of the erva relationship, then the marriage is worthless. And then there's nothing to talk about here in Sota. But on the other hand, if the violation only reaches the level of chayvei lavim, then the marriage is valid. Again, we're going to force him to divorce her, we'll beat him up, we'll give him 39. But right now, the marriage is valid. It's not kosher, we're not happy with it, he shouldn't have done it, we're going to give Malkus, but we recognize the marriage.
So he can still do it?
I don't know. Again, that's what you were asking. You know, we would, you know, the, again. How do I explain this? Shas is made up of many different mesechtas. We can't learn all of Shas at the same time. So what I'm asking you is to focus on what we're doing. I know it's a lot to ask of you. After the Shia, if you want to talk to me about whether or not a Kohen is married to Grusha is a lot of duchen, I'll give you a whole Shia on that. But that's not relevant to our discussion. Why? Because we have to learn other mesechtas to know who's kosher for duchening. We're not talking now about flagellating or punishing the Kohen. You know, he did a terrible thing. But we're talking about a b'dieved, a post facto situation. He's married to her. She's now married. Okay? Let's imagine, just for the fun of it, that he goes out to, I don't want to say China because that's a dangerous place today, but give me the name of
Cyprus.
Yeah, Cyprus is too close to home. But some way out, far out, you know, place where nobody, there are no Jews, and other, right? So he ends up in some little dorf, you know, somewhere out there, and nobody knows he's a Kohen, or nobody knows that she's a Grusha. Nobody knows, you know, they're new, Toshavim, new residents, no, they came from some country where they speak, I don't know, Swahili, I don't know what, and nobody knows these guys, okay? So what we do know is that he married her in front of two Edim. You know, he has a note from two witnesses, whatever it is, and we know he's married, and then he gives her kinyan and stira. Well, we find out by the time we get to the Beis HaMikdash that he's a Kohen and she's an Almana. So what do we do with her? And the Mishnah tells us because the marriage relationship was illegal, although it was recognized, in such a case, she doesn't drink Meimarar. Why? Because the marriage for Meimarar has to be not only legalized, but it not only valid, but it has to be legalized. Legalized means it has to be a kosher marriage. Here's another case. Okay, I'm skipping Chalutza for a minute. Now we have a case of Amzeres. Right, and Amzeres is a woman, a female in this case. I mean, you could have a Mamzer who's a male, so the same thing that I'm telling you about Mamzeres would apply to a male. She was born to a union between a man and a woman that were chayvei krisus. So in other words, if let's say a man would have a relationship with his sister, the child, the woman who's married, the girl who's married, who's born from that marriage is called a mamzeres. She's not allowed to marry a ben yisrael. She can marry a mamzer, she can marry a ger, but she cannot marry a yisrael who's neither a mamzer nor a ger. What happened? A regular rank and file Jew married this mamzeres. What's the status of this marriage? It's an illegal marriage because he wasn't allowed to marry her. He'll get malchus and he'll be posel and duchen. I'm just joking. But the marriage is valid. We recognize the marriage. She's a full-fledged Eishes Ish, but there's no din of sota. Why not? Because it's not a kosher marriage. Then we have something called an asina. Okay? An asina is a woman that comes from a nation called the Givonim. I don't know if you ever heard of them. They occupied Palestine, and they showed up to Yoshua, and they made a whole story, and they said, we came from a far-off land, and therefore you don't have to destroy us, because Yoshua had to destroy the seven nations. So they dressed themselves up in a certain way, and they fooled Yoshua, and Yoshua was fooled by them. And Yoshua let them live. He didn't destroy them. And later on in history, the descendants of the Givonim who occupied the land here, and they were allowed to live here because Yoshua was fooled by them, and they started playing games that they want to become Gerim and they want to convert, and basically their conversion was a kind of an iffy conversion. So that nation is prohibited. But again, I'm not telling you that the gerus is not valid. It's a very complicated situation. Maybe as a footnote here, he writes, I'll just read to you, he says, the Gibeonites deceptively, that's not bad, I didn't look at this, deceptively concluded a peace treaty with Yoshua under the pretense that they were not members of the seven Canaanite nations. And therefore, Yoshua didn't have to los chayikol neshama, that he didn't have to destroy them. Although the treaty was concluded under false pretenses, Yoshua abided by the treaty. That itself is a sugya. Why would Yoshua be obligated to recognize that treaty, a peace treaty, when he signed it under false premises? I don't know. After this episode, he assigned them as woodcutters. That's called Chotvei Eitzim, or water drawers, that's called Shovei Mayim, to serve in the temple. So they became the woodcutters and the water drawers for the temple. And because he appointed them, the word in Hebrew for appointing is Nesina, and they were called Nesina, hence the word Nesina. Nesina means they were assigned for those jobs. Now, Yoshua forbade any Jews from marrying Nesina as long as the Beis HaMikdash stood. When David HaMelech came, he became aware of the fact that these are barbaric people and we don't want to allow them to enter into the mainstream of Jewish community, and therefore he prohibited, even if they would somehow, I don't know exactly how, they snuck in and they were able to convert, but we're not allowed to marry them. So basically these are converts, but yet we're not allowed to marry them. Interesting. Fine. So now what happened? Somebody went ahead, he met a nice Nesina, a good-looking Nesina, and he decided to marry her. On a Torah level, because this Nesin underwent Gerus, again, we'd have to check this out, we'd send them to the rabbis, as you said before, and the rabbis did research, and they found out that, guess what? This girl came from a family of Nesinim, and they, or her father, or her mother, we have to know who, but there was a valid gerus. They were really sincere about their gerus, but still, we're not allowed to marry them. So because this marriage is prohibited by virtue of a decree that goes back to David HaMelech's time, therefore there's no sota, because the marriage is not a kosher marriage. Now let's flip it around. What happens if you have a mamzer? A mamzer is the same case that I gave you before. A man has a chiyuv krisus relationship with a woman. The child is a male in this case. He's called a mamzer. Everybody have that? Now the mamzer marries a bas yisrael. It's just the flip side of the previous case. Again, it's a case of chayvei lavim. It's not a kosher marriage, and there's no sota. Or let's say a nosin marries a Jewish girl. Again, the marriage is valid, but it's not kosher, and there's no sota. And that's what it says here: Ubas Yisrael Mamzer Ulenosin Lo Shosos. There's no parsha of sota with the Meimorim Velo Notos Ksuba, and there's no Ksuba. Now, again, why does she get penalized in this case? You could say that any forbidden marriage doesn't have a ksuba, but you could also say that even though she does have rights to a ksuba, she lost her rights because she violated the kinui and she had stira. V'elu lo shosos v'lo notos ksuba. Now, if you look at the Mishnah is divided up into three parts. The first part addresses valid marriages, kosher marriages, but it's not full-fledged marriages. It's the case of an arusa, where she stays in her father's house, so she's not tachas isha, or shomeres yom. The second category are non-kosher marriages, and they also are excluded from sota. Now we get to the third category, another group of ladies that are excluded from meimorim. However, it's not because there's something unacceptable in the marriage. Elu lo shosos v'lo notlos ksuba. These are not included in sota. Why? Homeris tmeani. And you may recall that all of the nuances of the ritual of sota are all geared towards one goal, one agenda, and that's to get her to what? To confess, right? You remember this? We discussed this even in the very rare cases that we got together, that all the different things that we do to her and sort of humiliate her, it's all because we want to squeeze out a hodah, meaning a confession. And she has to say two words, tmeani, which means I had this adulterous relationship. Once she admits that she had that relationship, there's no sota. No, number two, bola edim she tmeya. She still insists that she's innocent, but two witnesses testify that we saw her have this relationship. In other words, they didn't only see her seclude herself with that Joe, but she had a relationship with that Joe. And finally, we have a third case, homeres edi shosa. And again, this is a fascinating halacha, which again we're going to have a lot of fun with, that if she says, I don't want to drink, then she has the right to do so. Again, she'll be divorced, and she'll lose her ksuba, but she doesn't drink. In other words, the parsha of sota depends upon her consent, which is totally counterintuitive, and that's what we're going to have to study. What happens if the Baal says, I don't want to give her to drink? That's the next part of the Mishnah. Until now, the sota refused to drink. And if the sota refuses to drink, she doesn't deserve a ksuba. But what happens if the Baal says, "Eini mashka, I don't want to be part of this process, I'm out of here." Which means he's going to have to divorce her. Ah, in such a case, she has rights to a ksuba. Why? Because he was the one who decided that he doesn't want to go through this process of sota. She wants to go through it and prove herself guiltless. Now we have another case, and I think we once mentioned this case, Bala Ba'ale Baderech. You remember we used to accompany him with two scholars up to the temple because we're afraid that he might have a relationship with her. If he has this relationship with her on the way up, then there's no sota. But in these two cases, number one, where he refuses to have her drink, or number two, where he had a relationship with her, then although he has to divorce her because of Kirian Stira, but nevertheless she has rights to Aksuba. She doesn't drink the Bitmei Merarim, but she does have rights to Aksuba. So again, up until these last two cases, she doesn't have rights to Aksuba. But in this last two cases, she has rights to Aksuba. How are we doing on the clock? Sometimes I lose. Right, give me 5 more minutes, and then I'll let you go. Omar Baila, no, that we had already. Mesu Baalehem Ad Shalosh Shasu. What happens now? The husband is not around. He's gone. So imagine this. Everything was ready and everything was prepared. They went through the entire system where there was testimony, there was a court case, they prepared the mincha, everything was ready. The only last thing that was needed is that she should drink the waters, and there's Gishtarm, and he dies. So Beit Shammai Omrim, now I don't know if she murdered him, that I don't know, but anyway, Beit Shammai Omrim, no los ksuba velo shosos. Unfortunately, we don't have a husband here to be mashka her. There's no such thing as hashkas sota for her to drink unless he gives her to drink. I don't mean literally, he physically gives her to drink, but he has to be behind the whole process. He can't be behind the whole process because he's never under the ground at this point. But it wasn't her fault, and therefore she has rights to the ksuba. Again, she's going to collect the ksuba from what's called the Yerusha. The Yerusha means all the possessions that are left. And it's very interesting because the Yerusha goes now to their children, and they're not so eager to give it up to their husband's wife. It doesn't have to be their mother, because they're saying, well, she was guilty as accused. But no, she has rights to the ksuba. Why? Because she didn't violate she didn't undermine the process of Hashkas Sota. It was his fault that he died, so to speak.
But if there are no children, and she gets into the situation where there's a brother that's alive,
right,
does the case carry on?
Yeah, because she has rights to the ksuba. In other words, it's very interesting. A ksuba is not just a document. A ksuba generates what's called shibud, which is in English called a lien. You know, here's where the English translation is good. Usually I don't like English translations. Anybody know how to spell the word lien?
L-E-I-N.
Not L-E-A-N, right? Or L-E-E-N. It's L-E-I-N. So what happens is, when the Yarshim, whoever the heirs are, they inherit the estate, there's a lien on that property to pay her the ksuba. A ksuba is paid up in one of two situations. Either he divorces her, or alternatively he dies, and she collects the ksuba from his estate. And in this case that he died before he could give it a drink, it's equal to the previous case where he decided, I don't want her to drink. And in such a case is because he sort of intercepted, I don't know, I'm looking for a different word, but he interceded here to allow this process, which if it would have reached fruition, she would have hopefully proven herself guiltless. And therefore, since he's basically the gorem, he's the cause, she retains her rights to collect the ksuba. That's according to whom? That's according to Beit Shammai. Beis Hillel Omrim, O Shosos, O Lo Notlos Ksubasan. There's no such thing as a middle category where there's no shtia, there's no sota, but she gets her ksuba. Why? Because Basil says she loses Aksuba the very moment that she has Stira. She was secluded with another man. She loses her rights to the Aksuba. The only time she will regain her rights is if she can prove herself innocent. But in the absence of her ability, for whatever reason, even though he died, it's not her fault, but she cannot go through with the Ashkar Sota, and she cannot prove herself to be what? To be innocent? Then she loses Aksuba. Why? Because she's considered guilty until she proves herself innocent. So how far did we get? We got about halfway through the Mishnah? No. We got about, let's say, yeah, I think we could say we got about halfway through the Mishnah, no?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. We'll give ourselves a pat on the back. We're halfway through this Mishnah. Once we finish the second half of the Mishnah, then we really have a head start on this entire chapter, the fourth chapter of Sota, because this entire chapter is going to be built on this Mishnah. It's a very long Mishnah, and it's a very complicated Mishnah. Take a look at this chapter. Oh, I can't tell you, I'd have to turn a lot of pages here. But the chapter is, let's see, it goes up to Chaf Zayin Amid Beis. That's 27. So it's about 5 pages long. No, even less. I'd say 4 pages long. And this last chapter is really what I call the Kishkes of Masechta Sota. The other chapters are more procedural and more kodshim and a ton of agadita. This Masechta, I don't know if somebody ever did a scientific study, has more agadita than, you know, per page than any other Masechta Shas. And again, if you enjoy agadita, this is great. But for me, agadita requires a tremendous amount of study.
Is it Kabbalah that the agadita is based on?
A lot of it is based on Kabbalah. Most of it is based on what we call the Torah Shebaal Peh way of looking at verses in the Torah. In other words, you and I look at a verse in one way, and Chazal look at it in a totally different way. And what they did was, they actually gave us a book of ethics, and they weaved it into the Torah. A lot of Agaditas had to show it, you know, through the Psukim, and you and I would look at the Pasuk and say, what does that have to do? A lot of it also has to do with stories. And a lot of these stories are all just metaphors, you know what I mean? Do you follow what I mean by metaphor? Mm-hmm. So you'll learn some of the most bizarre stories, and you'll say, did that really happen? And many of Chazal will say it never really happened. There's a fascinating agadat in Brachos about two girls that were buried, and they communicate with each other after death, and a man sleeps in the cemetery and actually overhears them. And he learns from them what's going to happen the next year, because it was Rosh Hashanah time, and they flew, these two spirits flew Me'achori HaPargod, and they listened to what was going on, and they conversed with each other, and this man lying in the cemetery overhears their conversation, so he knows what to invest in, and he makes a killing on the stock market, because you know, they found out Me'achori HaPargod that this year, you know, a certain stock is gonna split, you know, it's gonna hit the ceiling, and the man invested. And the Gemara goes on and on. It's a very long, I got it to the story from here till doomsday. And the Ein Yaakov, which is the super commentary on Agadah, he says you can't take this Gemara literally. This never happened. And it's all symbolism. In that case, the Ein Yaakov actually gives us the symbolic interpretation. But otherwise, if we don't have that, it's like reading poetry, you know, and you got to figure out what the poet had in mind. And the poet uses, you know, terminology that's totally totally confusing and so forth and so on. So I both say, we'll pick this up on Sunday. You'll decide, let me know if you want me to learn Kudshin with you.
I think we already decided, right?
Well, you want to go on with
this? We're going to continue with it.
Yes.